Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did 9 years ago with the extraordinary Dick Hyman. As you probably all know, Dick is celebrating his 90th birthday and will be appearing many times at the Sarasota Jazz Festival as the festival attempts to celebrate this extraordinary human being. In this interview, Dick talks a lot about what it means to be a part of the culture that you were raised in and how that affected his approach to music. And he makes some surprising statements towards the end of the interview. Also, I am playing 4 separate cuts from Dick's various CDs. So hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Really can.
Lynn Show. As I said in the run-up, we're going to listen to a lot of Dick Hyman's music today, and that was called Fine and Dandy, and it was indeed Fine and Dandy. The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are. It's about recognizing that unfortunately too many of us come out of childhood needing to hide or deny some aspect of ourselves. It is my belief as a psychotherapist that this is a necessary and living a life in which you are not able to access all of who you are is uncomfortable at best and damaging at worst. And it is also my belief that if this happened to you, it is not too late to recover some of what you learned that you should be ashamed of or had to hide. The irony is that when you learn really early in your life that something about you, what you look like, what you sound like, how you laugh, what you're interested in, that you're somebody who is interested in the arts but you come from a family who are all jocks, or the other way around, everybody in your family is an artist of some sort and you only want to play baseball. If you've learned really early in your life that this thing about you is not okay, maybe you make too much noise when you eat. Maybe you laugh out loud and you come from a very sedate family. Maybe you got angry and you have parents who are afraid of the expression of anger. And so they made you feel that your very natural and human response is somehow ugly. If you came out of childhood having been forced to believe that something about you was unattractive, ugly, it was going to get you a response that you didn't want. It was not going to get you encouragement, care, support, love. It was going to get you criticism or neglect, ostracization, maybe even punishment or trauma. Well, children are very flexible. We learn to first pretend that, no, I'm not that, I don't like that, I don't do that. And after a while, having gotten so good at pretense, as I said, the irony is that we come into adulthood believing that we don't do that, that we don't have that, that we don't like that, that we're not like that. And so we're not even always consciously aware that we are in denial for something essential to us. Our ability to laugh spontaneously out loud, our ability to become angry, our interest in drawing or painting or playing baseball. So when I say that it's not too late to recover some aspect of yourself which you may have been in denial for, it may not be easy for you to recognize that you are in denial for something important about yourself. But you may feel, as many people have described, like a fraud. If you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. There's something about me. I'm not sure what it is, but I know that I can't let people really know me. Or there's something I really want to be or want to do, but somehow whenever I get close to it, I get scared. I always wanted to draw, and sometimes I have even dreamt about it or thought about it or thought about taking a class, but somehow something always gets in the way. I don't know, I forget or I make the appointment and then I don't go, or I decide it's too much money, or I decide it's silly, or whenever I find myself feeling angry, I have to shut that down. Well, again, if there is something that you either are consciously aware of that you are keeping from yourself, or that you would like to get, it may not be too late. It may not be too late to recover, to be your complete self. Of course, it is not as simple as saying, oh yeah, right, so now I'm going to do it. When we try and recover a quality, an aspect, an interest that was so crushed in childhood that we denied it, quite often what happens is the reason we denied it rises up inside us and stops us again. So if you are curious about this and you want to talk to me about it, you can go up to my website, thelynshow.com, thelynshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. There's an email tab up there. You can click on that and ask me any question that you might have. I'll be happy to answer. You can even get a copy of my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. You can even hear me reading the first chapter of the book. So, in order to make this point, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And in this interview with the remarkable, extraordinary, he says, I don't need adjectives, as you'll hear in the very beginning that Dick says, I don't need adjectives, and it's just as well, because I can't find them. This amazing man. Dick Hyman is a perfect example of someone who is exactly who he is. He was always noodling, exploring, discovering the piano, music, and being an artist and creating in so many varied styles is his life, and he lives it to the fullest. So this is an interesting interview because Dick speaks from the depth of his experience about what it means to be an example of the culture in which you were raised. It's a very interesting point of view, and I'm going to let Dick tell it himself. So we're going to listen now to Dick playing an original composition of his called Thinking About Bix. And after that, my interview with Dick Hyman. Thank you.
I'm sitting here with Dick Hyman. I was trying to think of adjectives for you, Dick, but I couldn't think of anything.
Oh, you don't need adjectives. You need descriptives.
Okay.
So I'm a pianist and composer these days. Occasionally conductor. Less and less a concert producer. And formerly an organist. How's that?
And a kind and generous man.
Well, that's not for me to say.
No, I'll say that.
Okay.
I'll say that. This is very generous of you. I know how busy you are. So I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you.
What I'm mostly interested in is what you would want to say about what it means to have spent a lifetime being an artist, something not that many people can pull off in this culture.
Well, that's all I know. That's all I've done is to try to be an artist. But of course, you can't just be an artist. You can't just create stuff. It's not. You have to do it for a purpose. And, oh, look at that black snake there.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
I know that he or they are underneath this thing.
Wow.
They're harmless, though.
We're at Dick's house, and he is pointing to his lanai where there is a slithering black snake going under the what?
Well,
the house?
Under the deck.
Under the deck.
Well, right. They can't go under the house, but under the deck.
Do they get in the pool?
That's happened, yeah.
Yeah, it happened. Wow.
Yeah.
But that surprises Junior.
Well, it hasn't happened that dramatically. So I was saying that it's one thing to be an artist and try to create stuff, but you have to do it for an audience or for other artists or for something, and that requires a degree of socialization and organization that not everybody is prepared to accept at the very beginning.
So were you at the very beginning?
Yeah, because with me and with most artists, it tied in with making a living, too.
Mm-hmm.
I made a living at it.
What is the very beginning for you?
The very beginning was playing the piano, exploring the keyboard, getting instruction on it from my big brother, who was very facile in playing, and who showed me the elements of the keyboard, and my uncle, who was a concert pianist, and again my brother, who brought home recordings of jazz classics, which indelibly imprinted me with much of the material I've used since. That was the beginning. And then in school, we formed ourselves into little kid bands and played dances. Same thing went on in college, and really the same thing went on after college. Largely, I was still becoming parts of bands and playing for dancing and for the college radio station, and everything was a segue, as we say in music. Everything followed. There wasn't any great change from playing for high school dances, playing for grown-up dances with a grown-up band later on, and playing for the college radio station and playing for public radio stations thereafter, and that's how it went.
So you always knew?
Yeah, I always knew. I was always playing the piano, always trying to, as I see it now, interact with other people through music.
So that came naturally to you? I mean, the desire to interact with other people through music.
Yes, it did. It seemed perfectly natural. I really wouldn't have known any other way to go.
Was your brother also a professional musician?
No, he did not become a professional musician. He became an amateur in the best sense of the word, and he became an educational psychologist. He retired about 10 years ago.
So, do you have other siblings?
No.
Just the two of you?
Yeah.
And, so, he became a doctor of sorts.
He has a doctorate in educational psychology,
right,
yes.
Right. So, was it all right with your family that you were going to be a musician?
My family was, as I look back on it, unexpectedly supportive. They really were fine about it. We had a musician in the family, my mother's brother, my uncle. And there was no attempt to make me into any other professional person. And it just all seemed to flow naturally. The only thing they insisted on was that I finish college and not go out on the road as I might have in my early teens. They were right about that, of course. I probably would never have gone back to college if I had left. So that was the only thing. They supported it. They supported an early marriage to Julia, which still survives. And I think they did that as a means of
anchoring you.
Pardon?
Anchoring you.
That's a good word. I was looking for the right word. Yeah. Not going crazy with the guys. So I've had a relatively moderate and less than wild life, even as a jazz musician, even as a bebopper, which I was for a while, or as a Dixieland musician, which I was for a while.
So you didn't, you weren't seduced?
No, I found early on that I didn't have to drink, I didn't have to smoke pot. People would, the other guys would respect that because I played well.
Yes.
It was that easy.
Yeah, right. They wanted you, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you started playing, how old were you when you started playing?
Oh, I imagine I was 9 or 10 or something like that.
Yeah, so you fell in love with it very young.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think falling in love is quite the term. I was completely empathetic with it.
Apathetic with it?
Empathetic.
Oh, empathetic. Thinking.
Yeah.
Empathetic, meaning
that, I mean, it just seemed the natural thing to do.
It was, yeah. Yeah, right. You know, I think that a lot of people feel that for one form of art or another, but they don't have your experience of it flowing so naturally into something that you can make a living at.
Well, for one thing, I think I was fortunate that I could start early. I have heard of professional musicians who started in their teens later on, and even later, and have made it, but I think that's the hard way. In a way, I wish I had started with rigorous technical practice early on as well. I had to kind of get to that a little bit later. But I don't think you can become a virtuoso of the highest order, such as the young Asian people we see so many of now, without having started Suzuki lessons at the age of 3.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, you said that you thought it was a good thing that your parents encouraged you to finish college and that you would not have gone back.
Yeah.
So what did you get there that you think is valuable?
Well, I went to Columbia in New York, and they emphasized the humanities and becoming educationally rounded. So I had a smattering acquaintance with the great books and the great trends in history and so forth and so on. I think that was good.
Yeah, so it was the information and cultural exposure.
It was the idea that you should be aware of what's happening and what has happened. Not that education there was anywhere near complete, but it gave me a kind of a point of view, which I'm trying to follow up on.
And did you study music there?
Well, I studied music in Columbia as far as I could, which was just as a major as part of a humanities degree. That is to say, a history of music, some counterpoint, a class in composition, and so forth. At the same, for one term, I doubled at Juilliard and studied orchestration there. That was useful. However, none of these things in music was as important as the practical on-the-job training I got thereafter, or as the couple of extracurricular things I did in college, playing on the campus radio station, playing in the campus dance band, this is one very good course. I took a course in chamber music, and I played, I learned a couple of things. I wish I had more of a repertory there, but at least I've been able to play something from the chamber music repertoire.
You're really all over the map anyway, musically. I mean...
Yeah, I've been known as...
Everything.
Yeah, I've been known as the chameleon, because largely because that was the character of Woody Allen's... That was the nature of Woody Allen's character in Zelig. He was the chameleon. And it's a name that stuck to me.
Oh, how funny.
In the business.
So actually, talk about that a little bit, because not everybody who's listening will know.
No, of course. I got to be involved with Woody Allen, first as a sideman, and then...
Sideman playing...
Playing.
With him?
Playing in various pickup orchestras for recording of his films, and then I gradually got to be the composer he called on when needed, and otherwise, to sum up, I arranged and composed and played and directed the music for, I don't know, 10, 11, 12 films or so. But that was, and of course that's, films are always with you. They're always seen and revived, and you have satisfying credits on the end of them. But really, that was just part of the general scene. I had two things going in those days. I was a jazz guy on the one hand, and I was a very active studio player. And what that meant was that you were available to play anything that anybody wanted at sight. That's just about what it was. And we did that constantly. It was a golden age of that sort of recording, and we recorded films and commercials and pop records, occasionally jazz records, and radio programs. And I'm old enough to have been there at the inception of television broadcasting, and we did that too. And I was on staff at NBC for 5 years in that sort of role. And then from piano and organ playing, I began inevitably to be an arranger and a conductor, because that comes naturally out of that background.
And the composing? That doesn't
necessarily... Well, the composing for me has come about from the fact that I'm constantly composing as a jazz player. That's what we do.
Yeah, right.
We improvise right. all the time. We're not just freely improvising. We're improvising according to certain specifications. I use that as the basis for my composing, for better or for worse. That's where it comes from with me.
That you discovered, figured out that what you were doing as a jazz player...
Yeah, it's the same source. Composing, formal composing, is... let's put it this way. Formal composing has a couple of fail-safe provisions. You can do it over. And every time you do it over, it's better, I've found. Being a jazz player is marvelous, but you have only one shot at it until the next time. But it's the same process. Composing means you can organize things much better. You can change the beginning, the ending, the middle, suddenly see a relationship between two things that you have been working with, put them together, take them apart. You have the chance to ruminate over the whole thing. And the jazz process is of the moment. And of course, it's much less organized and less verbal and wonderful in that respect. Composing allows you to, I hope, to take that and organize it a little better so that other people can play it also.
Yeah,
in collection or solo.
The jazz thing is completely spontaneous.
Well, yes, it is completely spontaneous. It isn't, but some people assume that it's completely freshly inventive all
yeah.
the time. It isn't quite that. You get into certain patterns. And you have to make decisions as to whether you want to do this pattern or that pattern or no pattern, which is really the most interesting exploratory part of it.
Yeah, but then, as you say, it goes by and it's over.
Yes.
And
unlike Julia's work, where she has to really plan a thing, she has a certain amount of improvisation at the beginning in deciding what she's doing, or perhaps when the stone determines... sometimes by breaking, how she will finish her sculpture. But her process is much more fixed than a musician's is. She's stuck with what she started to do, whereas we can decide all kinds of things, including just abandoning it. It's not nearly so much of a problem to abandon a song as it is to abandon a 100-pound piece of stone.
Now, it occurs to me that what Julia does is literally in stone.
Yeah, it literally is in stone, whereas we pride ourselves in not having it.
Well, and the other thing about something that you compose is that you can take a piece of it and use it somewhere else.
Oh, yeah, and I often do that. Everybody
does. Everybody does. I mean,
yeah.
So that you might abandon this whole, but you might have... things that you can salvage from it that you use other places.
Well, this is true. And you do this even without thinking about it. I mean, things that you have worked on and abandoned without your intention might show up in another thing because you've been there already.
Yeah, your unconscious has not forgotten it.
Exactly.
So I'm curious, is there a favorite activity for you?
Well, these days it's composing.
Mm-hmm.
I still continue to play, and I run around doing concerts very happily, but I'm doing what I think is the right thing for this age, which is getting pretty advanced. I'm staying home and writing more.
How old are you, do you mind?
I'm 81.
You were just, right, in March?
Yeah.
Yeah. You and I share the same astrological sign.
You're a Piscean?
I am.
Ah, okay.
And one of the things about this sign, I think, although I don't know if you're listening and you think I'm wrong, you can email me, that we like to do a lot of different things. So that even within the context of music, you do a lot of different things.
Oh, yeah, I do. I think I'm known for that.
Yes, I think that's right. And unlike some other Pisceans, you do all of them extremely well.
Well, I try.
Yeah, I think that's very clear. I think that's incredibly clear. You try. That's really important to you. Anyway, what's coming across to me is this desire to do it as well as you can do it, and maybe even as well as it can be done.
That's, of course, the goal. You have to settle for something less than perfection, of course.
But you're aiming.
Yeah.
Yeah, not everybody's aiming.
Hmm.
This has been really interesting and informative for me, and I'm wondering, will you take a second to think about what, if there was anything that you would want to say about what it means to be an artist, maybe what it means to be a musician, what it means to be an artist in this culture that we live in that's not particularly encouraging to artists? Anything that you would want to say, I would like to hear.
I'm not going to say that this culture is not encouraging to artists. In my own experience, I've been very encouraged.
Yes.
But of course, I've dealt mainly with accessible and popular music. If I had decided to become a 12-tone composer early on, I can see that I wouldn't have that impression. I think that you have to meet the culture.
Do you remember doing that consciously? Or was it just that you were drawn, that you are your culture, and so you were drawn to the things that your culture wanted? Do you know what I'm asking?
You're asking why I didn't become a 12-tone serial composer.
In a way, yeah.
As a teenager. It would have seemed silly to me. I knew nobody else who was doing that. I didn't like it when I heard it. I still don't care for it. So the alternatives to doing what I did, considering my background, were not present. That's what I do.
So in a way you were lucky to be drawn to what was also what would also want you.
Well, yeah. Not that there didn't have to be choices made. I mean, from my background, one could have gone into musical comedy, writing Broadway shows, writing film, writing altogether instead of, as I did, partially.
Pop songs.
Pop songs, all that, yeah. There are a lot of ways to have gone, and I have many friends, and I know lots of people who didn't specialize in one thing or other. I don't know. You go where your tendencies lead you, but then you want to have a broad idea of what the possibilities are, too. Sometimes you can get led by very, very trivial things like a phone call.
Are you thinking of something in particular?
No, I'm thinking of Sammy Kahn, the lyric writer. They asked him the old question of which comes first, the music or the lyrics, and he said, first comes the phone call.
Yeah, right. That's a professional musician.
Yeah.
Speaking.
Yeah. The phone call comes, and what you mean by that is that living in a society is important. Is what I started to say to begin with. It's not just a personal diary or meditations that won't be discovered for 200 years. You're part of this culture.
Yeah. And I do think that that's significant, that if you can continue to see yourself as part of the culture, then you don't see the culture as the enemy.
No, not that there haven't been trends within my little specialties that I didn't approve of, but they come and go.
Like what?
I really haven't been a part of pop music for a long time because it went in directions that didn't seem to be a part of my background. On the other hand, I have done a couple of rap things. So it's true.
you?
Yes, I have. Some of my things have been made into rap records. Some rappers like the backgrounds of Busta Rhymes, I'm proud to say, liked the background of one of my synthesizer records, and he used it for something. And I never met him, but we've been great collaborators on that one piece.
So you continue to be a part of your culture?
Well, I suppose so, now that you think of it. From all of that, from all the rap music about 10 years ago, I made some pieces for piano. I call it just that, three raps for piano. I played them in concert just the other night.
At the Universalist?
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry I missed that. Mm-hmm. And actually, I found out too late.
They didn't publicize it enough. Yes. So I understand that. But in general, I've come to see that one's period in music and possibly in art is what you came up with.
You mean grew up with?
What you grew up with, up through perhaps by the age of 50, you know that stuff very, very well. And after that, it becomes a little bewildering.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you've been really able to to stay current.
Well, I still stayed current until a relatively short time ago, but I'm not sure I want to bother now.
Yeah, but that's an entirely different thing that you might not want to bother.
I find I have enough to use in my composing.
Yes.
I don't have to stay au courant for every little wrinkle that comes up. I have plenty to work on, and that's what I'm doing.
And what are you composing these days?
Well, I've just finished a second string quartet, which will be premiered in the fall. Last December, I believe it was, we did a trio for piano, violin, and cello. These are in classical venues.
Yes.
But I'm writing what I want to write, so there's plenty of jazz in it, and the trio has some rock quotes in it, which amuse me.
You are wonderful.
You're not supposed to say that.
I'm not?
No.
Who was supposed to say that?
My wife.
I'm quite sure we can get her to say that as well. This was so generous of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We did get to hear Julie say lovely things about Dick because I interviewed her at the same time. But this show is all about celebrating the 90th birthday of Dick Hyman. And as you heard, this is a man who always knew who he was, has never questioned it, continues to expand on it, to explore it, to be more and more and more what he is, not needing to be what others are, not needing to go in the way that the culture went, except, of course, to experiment with rapping. No, Dick is wholly himself, and it is because of that that his work has been so successful and so celebrated and so loved. I want to say here that, as I said earlier, you can find me at my website, thelynshow.com. That's thelynneshow. thelynshow.com. And as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show. Maybe it's just that you enjoyed listening to Dick's music, and we are going to go out on yet one more tune. This will be Tea for Two. But as always, as I said, I hope you got something from this show, something that will bring you back, because as always, I will be back next week, same time, same station. And I sure hope you will be too. Thank you.
I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a
fight, no, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly, well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get, I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper, I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So